As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Friday, April 24th, 2009. We would now like to turn the call over to Matt Ginter, Vice President of Investor Relations for 3M.
Thank you, Rachel, and good morning, everyone.
I'm joined today by George Buckley, 3M Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer,
and Pat Campbell, 3M Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. Today's call will summarize 3M's first quarter financial results. A conference call slide presentation will accompany our comments, which you can access on 3M's Investor Relations website at 3M.com. The slide presentation will also be archived on our website for an extended period of time, along with a replay of today's audio webcast. Please take a moment, as always, to read the forward-looking statement on slide 2. During today's conference call, we'll make certain predictive statements that reflect our current views and estimates about our future performance and financial results. These statements are based on certain assumptions and expectations of future events that are subject to risk and uncertainties. Item 1A of our most recent Form 10-K lists some of the most important risk factors that could cause actual results to differ from our predictions. As a reminder to all, we filed an 8-K with the SEC on April 9th detailing a few minor product category shifts between businesses, as well as the implementation of a new dual credit reporting model for those U.S.-based businesses that share customer channels to a certain degree. In short, this change will serve as a catalyst to encourage U.S. businesses to sell all 3M products. The numbers presented in the press release today reflect those changes. So let's begin today's review. Please turn to slide number 3, and I'll turn things over to George.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for listening to our first quarter call. A challenging quarter unfolded pretty much as we expected, with the exception that, like many of our contemporaries, the end markets were a bit tougher even than we had thought they would be. Automotive unit volumes were down 40-50%, with similar-sized contractions to this in electronics. Housing starts continued to worsen even off an already gloomy base. Net-net, we had an expected organic sales volume to be down in the range 15-18%, but they came in slightly below that at -19.5%. We predicted in our last call that this quarter would be the most challenging of the recession, but the overall business conditions in Q1 were even weaker than we had forecast. The run rate of sales for January, February, and March were all very similar, so at the gross level, there was no material sign of recovery yet. So it is indeed, as we predicted in January, getting worse before it gets better. While it's not a surprise for us, one always hopes for better. What we should all celebrate, however, is that even in with these massive volume declines, which are unprecedented in modern times for 3M, we maintained an overall operating margin at a stellar 17.1%. The good news also is that we still made our internal operating plan on earnings despite the volume shortfall. That was obviously driven by a very tight and effective cost control by our leadership team and great performance in our factories, even with these significant volume declines. On an FYI basis, the movement to stock option expense from the traditional second quarter to the first quarter negatively affected quarterly earnings by 4 cents, and the loss of absorption on the sharp inventory corrections we've made in Q1 cost us about 7 cents. This does not include the effect of market-related volume falls. There was also a loss in converting cash to dollars in Venezuela. That cost us 2 cents, and Pat will discuss all of these items further in a few minutes. We're obviously controlling all those things which are in our power to control. In the quarter, we announced a reduction in staffing levels across the world by another 1,200 people, and we continue to streamline our manufacturing operations. Indirect spending is running at 20% or so less than last year's levels, so we have the spending buttoned up tightly, without, so far, negatively affecting our R&D spend. We remain confirmed believers that we must still invest in innovation for as long as we can. It's our future. Business conditions in our industrial and transportation segment and electronic communications were very tough, as was the consumables portion of our safety and security business. In contrast, healthcare remained reasonably robust, as did consumer and office, which continues to buck the trend. Display and graphics saw large falls in sales too, but oddly, we began to see growth in eco-friendly TV component sales. We had steady performance in traffic safety systems, renewable energy, and personal care products as well. On the currency front, a third of the total company sales decline for the quarter was due to FX impact of a negative 7.1%. In the international markets, we saw an 11% FX translation headwind in the first quarter, a huge impact. But in March, we saw more countries exceeding last year's local currency sales numbers than we'd seen in either January or February. There is a sense that the tiniest bit of momentum is building there, even if it turns out only to be the false dawn of inventory replenishment. Those very early green shoots of improvement are, as might be expected, mostly in the faster turn inventory businesses such as electronics and flat panel TVs. Pat will give you some more detail later, but I was pleased to see that our inventory has fallen substantially in the quarter. We expect that this trend will continue for the next few quarters. Our internal target is to reduce inventory over the balance of the full year by the same amount that we did in Q1. Offsetting this a little, receivables increased in March for the first time in several months. Now I'll turn the call over to Pat for some detail on the first quarter. Pat?
Thanks, George, and good morning, everyone. On a GAAP reported basis, earnings were 74 cents per share versus last year's $1.38. Excluding special items, this quarter's earnings were 81 cents per share, which, as George mentioned, was a few cents above our internal plan. Pre-tax restructuring charges totaled $67 million in the first quarter, or 7 cents per share. The majority of this amount related to severance costs associated with about 1,200 jobs that George just mentioned. The reductions span all major geographies, both particular emphasis on the U.S., Latin America, and Western Europe. On a business-by-business basis, the most significant reductions were in industrial and transportation, our largest segment, and one that has been heavily impacted by the recession, and in corporate, related to ongoing downsizing of our back-office operations. These reductions will save 3M $70 million annually, with $40 million in 2009. Restructuring is never easy, but right-sizing our cost base is absolutely necessary in light of much lower demand levels. We have tried to be prudent yet proactive with restructuring during this recession, and since the second quarter of last year, we have reduced our global workforce by 4,700 positions. On top of this, we have also taken out a significant number of contractors. We have furloughed or temporarily laid off well over 1,000 others in response to slower sales. The challenge, of course, is to balance short-term demand declines with longer-term resource needs. We continue to work this balance every day. You will see additional actions from 3M in the second quarter, the size and scope of which are still being determined. We had a few other items affecting both reported and adjusted Q1 earnings that many of you may not or could not possibly have known about. The first relates to stock option expense, where we just recently changed the timing of our annual employee stock option grant from May to February. If you will recall, the retirement eligible portion of the annual option grant must be expensed at the time of the grant. Now that we grant options in Q1 versus Q2 in previous years, the expense has shifted forward by one quarter. This added about 4 cents per share of cost to this quarter that was not in last year's Q1 results. Full year 2009 option expense will be very similar to 2008. The details of this change were spelled out in our annual 10-K, but I know that some of you have waited to update your models until after earnings. Second, we absorbed approximately 2 cents per share of costs related to our decision to swap Venezuelan bolivars into U.S. dollars. Economic conditions in Venezuela have continued to deteriorate, with escalating inflation pressuring the currency. We are aggressively managing the cash flow risk as a result. We expect to initiate further such swaps in 2009, costing somewhere in the range of 2 to 3 cents per share spread over the next three quarters. Lastly, we aggressively reduced inventory levels in the first quarter, which negatively impacted gross margins by about 1.5 percentage points, or the equivalent of about 7 cents per share. Earnings exceeded our internal plan, and after considering these items, that may not have been factored into all your models fully, we believe our results were more favorable than they may appear on the surface. Let's take a look at first quarter sales performance on slide 5. This was a quarter unlike any that most of us have ever seen. And while our businesses fought for every sales dollar, the degree of decline in some of our key markets could not be overcome. For example, in consumer electronics, global manufacturing output contracted by anywhere between 20 and 50%. Another example is automotive OEM, where global production is expected to decline year on year by almost 30% in 2009. In the first quarter in North America alone, light vehicle production declined by 50%. Taken together, electronics and automotive comprise almost one quarter of our revenues. A number of other served industries declined at double-digit rates as well. Digging into the numbers, worldwide 3M sales declined 21.3% in the first quarter. Organic volumes declined 19.5% versus a previous expectation of down 15 to 18%. And the stronger U.S. dollar reduced first quarter sales by about 7%. On the positive side, we increased global selling prices by over 2%, and acquisitions added over 3 points to sales. Organic volume declines were most severe in Asia Pacific at 24%, driven largely by the previously mentioned contraction in electronics, automotive, and basic manufacturing. This had a significant impact on our display and graphics, electrical and communications, and industrial and transportation businesses. The bright spot for APAC was in healthcare, which posted positive single-digit growth rates for the quarter. U.S. organic volumes declined 19.6%, with healthcare and consumer office declining in the mid-single-digit range, while our more economically sensitive businesses, such as electrical communications and industrial transportation, posted organic volume declines north of 30%. Organic volumes declined 17% in Europe and 14% in the combined Latin America-Canada region. On a more positive note, we've been able to hold prices such that last year's increases provided a net year-on-year benefit in Q1 of just over 2%. Prices rose 3.5% in the U.S., 1.9% in Europe, and 8.7% in the combined Latin America and Canada region. Of course, much of the increase in Latin America was a direct offset to the impact of the strong U.S. dollar. Price declines by 1.5% in Asia Pacific. This was all electronics related, so there's no surprise there. On a worldwide basis, sales in local currencies declined 13.9%. Our strongest performers were healthcare at plus 2% and consumer office, which was flat year on year. Elsewhere in the portfolio, sales in local currencies declined by 3.6% in safety, security, and protection services, 21% in industrial and transportation, 27% in display and graphics, and 30% in electro and communications. Turn to slide 6, please. Despite sales being down 21%, we delivered an outstanding 17.1% operating margin in Q1. Our business teams are really driving operational excellence to the bottom line during this difficult economic period. Gross margins were 45.9%, down 2.5 points from last year's first quarter, with declining volumes and inventory reductions playing the most significant roles. Many of our customers and most of our own businesses shut down their operations for some period of time in the first quarter. Typically, we experience this in the fourth quarter, but obviously this is a different time. We successfully reduced inventories in Q1, which helped our cash flow, but reduced gross margins by an estimated 1.5 points. Regardless, that's the right way to run the business, particularly in this recession. And although raw materials in general have declined, we turned mostly high-priced inventory in Q1, given that we use FIFO accounting. Also, the previously mentioned Venezuelan currency cost was booked to cost of goods sold. This adjustment reduced gross margins by a little over 30 basis points. SG&A spending discipline was good in Q1. Costs were down 10% year-on-year, which obviously was not enough to keep up with the volume decline, but still reflects a lot of hard work by 3Mers in every business in every corner of the world. We have talked extensively to you about our efforts to hold the line in G&A expense, and in fact, we reduced these expenses by 14% in the quarter. Our teams have gotten the message that maintaining cost discipline during this extraordinary recession is critical. R&D expense was down 8.7% year-on-year, but up a point as a percent of sales to 6.3%. As we have said many times, during recessions like this, all areas of the company need to tighten their belt, including the labs. But we are resisting the temptation to cut so deep as to jeopardize programs that will seed future growth. We believe that 6% of sales is a healthy level of investment in the business. Operating income was $870 million, down 42%, which, again, was above our expectations. This negative leverage was not surprising considering our high gross margins, coupled with a 19.5% organic volume decline. But bear in mind that the inverse also holds true. Net interest expense increased $19 million, driven primarily by higher net debt levels and lower yields on cash deposits. The first quarter tax rate was 30.3%, down 1.5 points year on year, due to continued excellent tax planning efforts and, of course, lower profit levels. Just a few years ago, our tax rate was well north of 32%. So I'm pleased that we continue to make steady and sustainable progress on this front. For 2009 in total, we anticipate a tax rate slightly below 31%. Net income was $563 million, down 43%. As I mentioned earlier, earnings per share was 81 cents, a decline of 41%. Now let's turn our attention to the balance sheet and cash flow on slide number 7. Net working capital declined by a healthy $605 million year on year. Inventory declined by $361 million, and inventory turns declined slightly to 4 at quarter end. Breaking down the $361 million of inventory decline, foreign exchange translation reduced the balance by $287 million. However, acquisitions net of divestitures added $172 million for the quarter. The remaining inventory reduction of $246 million represents the underlying difference between our factory output and sales. We've made some good progress in Q1, but we have more to go as our 2009 inventory goal is to improve by a minimum of a half a turn. Accounts receivable decreased $677 million year on year, and turns were 6.6 at quarter end. Again, going through the pieces, foreign currency translation reduced receivables by $353 million, and acquisitions net of divestitures added $144 to the year-on-year balance. The underlying reduction in receivables was therefore $468 million, which of course was directly related to a slower overall sales. When we began to see the U.S. economy slow in late 2007, we immediately put additional focus on managing customer credit and have heightened the awareness across our global operations as well. We have seen some slowdown in customer payments during this period of tight credit, but thus far nothing of an alarming nature, and we will remain prudently cautious in extending terms until we are more confident that overall economic conditions and credit availability are back to normal levels. Accounts payable declined $433 million versus last year, primarily due to much lower CapEx, raw material, and indirect spending during the quarter. Free cash flow declined by $248 million year-on-year to $451 million. Net income declined by $470 million, largely offset by a $461 million improvement in working capital performance. CapEx declined by $54 million to $244 million in the quarter. We expect full-year CapEx to be $900 million, or down 40% versus 2008. Pension-related contributions increased by $74 million year-on-year, and restructuring cash payments increased by $96 million. Finally, as many of you know, we have redesigned our incentive comp system. Until recently, payments were made quarterly based upon the quarter's performance, whereas now they are paid in the first quarter following our assessment of annual business results. This resulted in $55 million of higher cash outflows in the first quarter, which of course is offset in the other three quarters of the year. Traditionally, our free cash flow conversion in the first quarter is the weakest of each year due to the higher March sales compared to December, which negatively impacts our first quarter working capital performance. Such was the case again this year. Regardless, free cash flow conversion was 87% versus 70% in last year's first quarter. Were it not for the timing change related to incentive comp, conversion would have been slightly greater than 100%. We continue to target a minimum of 100% conversion for 2009 in total. Dividends paid to common shareholders total $354 million this quarter. We once again raised the per share dividend by 2% in February, which was the 51st consecutive annual increase for the company. Not many companies have this track record. Finally, as I mentioned on last quarter's call, our cash flow forecast for 2009 reflects no share repurchases. Our preference at this moment is to preserve cash and maintain optimum liquidity. That wraps up my comments on total company performance. Now let's quickly review the performance of our business units. I will review those segments most impacted by the current economic climate first, then conclude with those less impacted. Please turn to slide number 8. The industrial transportation team is doing an outstanding job managing through end market declines, the likes of which the business has never experienced. Three industries in particular, automotive, electronics, and appliances, touch about one half of industrial transportation sale base. So, for example, when you see 50% declines in first quarter North American auto builds, a 25% contraction in January production of major appliances, and a 20 to 50% decline in global electronics, you can understand why our first quarter sales are what they were. Sales in the business declined 28% to $1.58 billion, and margins declined 10.2 points to 12.4%. Sales in local currencies declined 21%, including a 2.8% benefit from acquisitions. We have acquired some outstanding companies in the past year that complement our business perfectly, including McGuire's in the automotive aftermarket space, along with Polyfoam and Amphi in the adhesives and sealants area, to name just a few. The integration of these businesses has gone very well, and we remain convinced they will add significant value to the franchise. Given the market declines that I mentioned, it was not surprising that automotive OEM-related businesses were down over 40% in local currency. The abrasives and industrial adhesives and tapes business performed better, with local currency declines in the 20s. On a more positive note, sales declined at only a mid-single-digit rate in our renewable energy division and in automotive aftermarket. Last but not least, our performance care business posted slightly positive local currency growth in the quarter. Looking at the business geographically, local currency sales declined 4.8% in Latin America, 19.5% in Europe, 22.5% in the United States, and 26.2% in Asia Pacific. Sales in Japan in particular were down 36% in local currency. The global ITB leadership team is aggressively managing through this recession using all the tools available as necessary. They announced restructuring actions in Q1, along with planned shutdowns, furloughs, and mandatory vacation across the operation while the global economy continues to struggle. Industrial and transportation will be well positioned for stellar sales and profit growth once the global economy begins to rebound. Please turn to slide number 9, where I will comment on the performance of our electro and communications business. This business is also working hard to overcome significant end market declines. About half of the electro and communications business is linked in some fashion to the global electronics industry. So the mega declines I mentioned on the prior chart were a factor here as well. Semiconductor shipments, which impact our carrier tape business, were down 30% in the quarter. The remainder of electro and communications is largely tied to infrastructure, including non-residential construction, power transmission and distribution, and telecom, all of which are projected to be down more than 20% in 2009. So our electro communications team had its hands full as well in the first quarter. Sales were $480 million in the quarter, down 35% year-on-year, and profits were a positive $24 million. Sales were down 30% in local currencies, with near 20% declines in telecom and electrical products, and 40% plus declines in those businesses that serve the electronics industry. Local currency declines 39% in the United States, 35% in Asia Pacific, 17% in Europe, and 14% in Latin America. Now please turn to slide 10, and let's take a look at our display and graphics business. This business has been seen aggressive inventory adjustments and end market contractions as a result of both the commoditization of optical films and, of course, the global recession. Sales were down 30% in dollars and 27% in local currency compared to last year's first quarter. Profits declined 65% to $66 million. Sales in our optical systems business declined 44% in the quarter, and profits were down 75%. As we have discussed on prior calls, optical has transitioned from being a very high-growth business to one that is much more mature. The most significant part of this transition began in the second quarter last year. Therefore, year-on-year comparisons remain quite difficult in the first quarter. These challenging year-on-year comparisons will begin to wane starting in Q2. The year-on-year decline in optical systems reduced the overall sales growth rate for D&G by 12 percentage points. On a more positive note, our optical team was successful in developing a number of new film solutions for what is commonly called EcoTV. 3M's proprietary multi-layer film solutions enable an OEM to produce a more energy-efficient LCD TV by using fewer bulbs in combination with our films. We are gaining some nice traction in this area. Sales in our commercial graphics business were down 27% as customers have cut back on branding, media, and advertising plans. They too are wrestling with this challenging global recession. On the positive side, sales in traffic safety systems were about flat in local currency. This business is anticipating some boost in sales this year from the recent Washington stimulus package, a portion of which is expected to be used for highway infrastructure projects. Now please turn to slide 11, where I will discuss details of our safety, security, and protection service business. Sales declined 15% in the first quarter in this business to $694 million. In local currency terms, sales declined only 3.6%, with acquisitions adding 10.6 points to first quarter growth. Operating income declined 34% to $129 million, and margins remained at a very healthy 18.6%. A good performance considering the economic environment. Double-digit declines in most industrial end markets drove near 20% organic local currency sales declines in personal protection products, which is the largest business within safety, security, and protection services. In our security systems business, which is not economically cyclical, local currency growth was down just a few points. In terms of new business development, our security systems team successfully closed yet another passport supply contract during the quarter, this time to a prominent country within Europe. The 2008 divestiture of High Jump software business negatively impacted sales growth by 2.2% in the quarter. Please turn to slide 12, where I will recap the quarter for our consumer and office business. This business turned in a stellar performance in the first quarter, considering that both businesses and consumers both retrenched, cutting back significantly on their spending. While worldwide sales contracted by 7%, this was all currency related. Sales in local currency were flat year on year, which included approximately 3 points from acquisitions. In the fourth quarter of 2008, we acquired Futuro, a leading supplier of compression supports and hosiery, which complements our existing consumer retail healthcare business. In addition, the retail portion of Aero, a company we acquired in April of 2008, was assigned to the consumer office business in January 2009. In the U.S., we delivered 4.5% sales growth, despite significant declines in foot traffic in most large retailers. We achieved this result in two ways. One, the Futuro and Aero acquisitions added 4 points to the U.S. growth. And two, we continue to drive penetration of new and existing products throughout our customer base, again, despite negative same-store sales. A great example of this is our branded Filtrete business, where new products combined with innovative merchandising programs are driving strong double-digit growth. So again, despite tough end market conditions, this business did a great job in the first quarter. Now please turn to slide 13, where I will discuss the results from our most profitable segment, healthcare. This was definitely the bright spot in our portfolio in the first quarter. Local currency sales increased by 2 percentage points. Organically, prices offset volume declines, and acquisitions added 2 points. Currency impacts reduced sales by almost 10 points, so total sales declined 8% to just under $1 billion. Local currency growth was led by the oral care and medical businesses, along with solid performance in all international regions. Health information systems was about flat year on year. Our drug delivery systems business posted local currency sales declines in Q1, but are expected to turn positive in the second half of the year. This business does have a tendency to be a little lumpy when measuring quarters. Operating margins were an outstanding 31.2% in healthcare, a year-on-year increase of 1.4%. So despite the 8% sales decline, profits were down just 3% in the quarter. And as in consumer office, profits would have been flat year-on-year were it not for the timing change with stock options. That wraps up my discussion of the portfolio. So now I will turn it back to George, who will describe our 2009 outlook. George?
Thank you very much, Pat. The question I think you're going to be most interested in is, what about the balance of the year? I think we all know that this subject is very complex to explain, but I'll try to give you the best verbal description I can of how we expect the year to unfold, backed up by a couple of charts. We all know that long cycle businesses have far better order visibility than we do. So a view on the economy's performance rather than on an order book is the key to how we see the forecast and balance of the year. In 3M's case, it's all happening real time. So the good news is that the economic pressure will also subside here first. We are, in fact, a good bellwether of what is happening to the economy on a real-time basis. Our internal economic forecast suggests mildly weaker end market conditions in Q2 than those we saw in Q1. So we still expect a little more downward momentum in the economy in Q2, though the rate of sequential decline, the second derivative, shall we say, is likely to get a little bit better from here on in. That view is also supported by external econometric models. But to offset this continued end market weakening, cost reductions from recent restructuring and other actions that we've taken will take greater hold in Q2 than they did in Q1. Additionally, toward the middle or later part of the quarter, I expect that some of the inventory correction transients, which have caused such steep declines in sales for everyone, will subside too, particularly in our faster inventory-turning businesses, such as electronics. That will probably begin in Q2, but we should see its full effect somewhere in Q3. We have a couple of pretty tough quarters behind us, and likely one or possibly two more in front of us. While most of us believe the world economy will recover in due course, few have the knowledge or the confidence to predict when that recovery might be. But whether we like it or not, at this time, and at some level, we're all in the forecasting business. I don't think it's enough just to say, I don't know. So on that topic, it is our view that the U.S. economy will bottom somewhere between the end of the second and the end of the third quarter. We'll probably see sequential quarter-over-quarter improvements after that, though not returning to the same level of economic activity that we had in 2007 until 2011. I also think Europe will lag a U.S. recovery by a quarter or two. Some observers are a little more optimistic than me on this European topic, suggesting a European recovery will run parallel with the United States, but I'm not so sure. Asia, with the exception of Japan, should actually help lead us out of the recession. And in the vanguard of that movement regionally will be China, and market-wise it will be electronics and the internal Chinese economy. There is no reason to believe that automotive in the region, or anywhere else for that matter, will improve anytime soon. That will be driven by consumer confidence, which is likely to lag real improvements in the economy. Electronics markets apart, it's hard to see any good news emerging in Japan's economy until well into 2010. What makes this year so difficult to predict accurately is that it's a huge year of transitions, both in volume shrinkage, as our end markets declined and supply chains drained, but also the reverse, as pipelines refill, albeit to some lower level, consistent with weaker end markets. The dynamics which apply to pipeline emptying should generally also apply to pipeline filling. But I think that the filling will probably stutter a bit at first, perhaps introducing a bit of hysteresis into the system. The restart will probably be affected by shortages of business credit and the need for building greater business confidence. And then, after that has happened, pipelines will probably fill fast. The key area that we have affecting a recovery is threefold. Business credit availability, growing unemployment, and candidly, low aggregate demand. Stimulus packages are important longer term, but I think their effect is limited short term, particularly in the United States. But to be very clear here, we've not included in our forecasts any fast refill of inventory pipelines, even though it is likely to happen when the economy eventually makes the turn. What is unknown with any degree of accuracy is how much of the organic volume in declining Q1 was due to weekend market conditions and how much was due to inventory corrections in the various distribution channels that we use. If we use blended IPI data as an indicator, and I'll just remind you that the worldwide IPI Q1 forecast was -13.6%, it would suggest that about a third of the organic volume decline at 3M was due to inventory corrections. But it is clearly difficult to know with any certainty. But as Keane said, we're looking for directional accuracy here, not absolute precision. I think the severity of the end market contractions and the consequent greater difficulty of quickly driving out excess inventory will make the channel implicitly less efficient at clearing inventory than it would have been if the sales falls were less severe. So the effect of this is that it would possibly stretch out the period where sales would be depressed due to this inventory correction factor. In terms of forecasting, the two quarters which swing the year are the late second and the fourth. The second because that is when the inventory transients I just mentioned should begin to die down in some businesses. And the fourth quarter because that is when year-over-year comparisons turn in our favour. So in summary, we expect the second quarter end markets to be similar or possibly a bit worse than Q1 in the early part of the quarter, with improving results toward the end. The timing of any improvement in our wholesale sales in Q2 is much more connected to the clearing of excess inventory than it is to any material improvement in our end markets. I do not expect to see much in the way of end market improvements until at least Q3 or possibly even Q4. At 3M, we expect Q3 to show sequential improvements over Q2 as more channels finish drawing down inventory and some end markets also begin to improve slightly. Our modelling also shows Q4 to have marginally better end market conditions than Q3. Adding all of these factors together, the year will turn out to be somewhat more challenging than we had originally expected. We believe that organic sales volumes will come in somewhere between -11% and -15%, and that EPS will come in somewhere in the band of $3.90 to $4.30. I'll now give you a bridge to the 390 EPS number. Please turn to slide 15. Assuming that we are at, or close to, dragging bottom on end market sales, and we believe that we are, the base level of earnings for this calculation would be Q1's 81 cents multiplied by 4, which we at reels $3.24. As we've already mentioned, because first quarter stock option expense is the highest of the year, we realize the benefit spread out evenly over the year of 11 cents versus the Q1 run rate. That takes us to $3.35. In Q2, we expect to see take up of an early retirement program we've just begun. We'll also do some further restructuring, principally in Asia and Western Europe. In combination with previous actions, this restructuring adds another 20 cents to the year. We also expect vacation policy changes that we've talked to you about before to add 8 cents. This gets us to a subtotal of $3.63. Moving on to the next item in the chart, even in a recessionary environment, many of our businesses will still see seasonal upticks later in the year as opposed to the first quarter. Examples include consumer and office, and their back to school and holiday orders, and traffic safety systems linked to the road construction season. The year-end holidays also boost consumer electronics. Considering these patterns, we expect about 16 cents of additional profit versus the Q1 run rate, which takes us to 379. Finally, this low-end scenario would put us well below our original operating plan, resulting in lower variable incentive compensation versus the Q1 run rate. This would add 11 cents to earnings. Adding it all up, we believe that $3.90 per share is a reasonable estimate on the low end, again, using Q1 as our base. Other than the seasonality issue, the low end of our range assumes no improvement in sales volume for the entire year, which we don't believe will be the case. Let's think about this. A year where end markets are as bad as Q1 and excess inventory takes all year to clear the channel is highly unlikely without the influence of another as yet unknown financial or other catastrophe. So we believe that there will indeed be some additional volume increases, and I'll discuss that when I walk through the high-end scenario in just a minute. To get to the high end of our range, we vary only volume. 4 points of additional growth, which represents the difference between our high-end and low-end volume assumptions, would yield 45 cents of additional earnings for the year, with a corresponding variable comp adjustment of 6 cents, which is included in that total. And this puts the high end at 430 for the year. We've not included in our calculations for either end of the range is the likely benefit from better inventory absorption in the remainder of the year. In the first quarter, it had a negative effect of 7 cents. We think that this will be the highest such impact of any quarter in 2009, leading to a possible benefit in the range of 14 cents for the balance of the year. This should give us some cushion against the unknowns. While nobody, me included, likes to reduce forecasts, this estimate reflects our best thinking about the year at this moment. It also reflects yeoman's work by the good people at 3M in this quite unprecedented fall in economic activity around the world and the large currency headwinds that we still face. As you can see, we remain very positive in our attitudes and outlook, figuring we're now about half to two-thirds of the way through the knothole before the turn in the economy comes. So we figure there's no more to go through than we've been through already, and we know how to deal with it. A process of Darwinian economics is unfolding in the marketplace as the recession continues, and we're gaining share in many places. Customers are recognizing the benefits of being with a great and reliable partner like 3M. We're also fortunate that we can invest in the future in a way that many of our competitors and peers cannot right now, and yet still make great margins. We clearly intend to become stronger on a relative basis during this tough time. We continue to be focused on cash generation as the best means of inoculating us against the downturn, and R&D is the best way to prepare us for the future. The logic that we will come out of this faster than long-cycle peers is compelling, and we continue to see our company as a great place to invest right now and a great place to be in these times. And with that, I'd like to turn the call over to you for questions. Thank you very much for listening.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. If you are on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before entering your request. Please limit your participation to one question and one follow-up. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Our first question comes in line of David Begleiter with Deutsche Bank. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
George, your outlook is a little more cautious than others I've spoken with in the last week and a half in terms of signs of sequential improvement over the last few weeks. First off, is your April tracking better than March? And what is unique about your business that would suggest you might lag some of your material peers in seeing some sequential improvement in demand?
Thanks, David. I think that April is running about the same as March right now. I said in my conversation here, Dave, that I think that there's obviously going to be a little bit of washover from the first quarter and the second. But toward the end of the second quarter, I think that things are going to begin to turn. I also mentioned that we have seen some improvements in some of the faster turning businesses, even a little bit in industrial. We obviously don't want to get out ahead of this thing in the way we're interpreting it, and we're trying to be cautious and trying to be balanced in our opinions about this. But I think we're also pretty clear, David, that the economy will make the turn by the end of the second. If the cycle is a little longer than historical experience. It might take another quarter, but we're pretty certain that we'll see some improvements in the second, David, and then continuing improvements in the third. You just got to be careful that in the second, I think what's likely to happen, David, is some of the inventory transits are going to die down, and that's probably where you're going to see the improvement. So I think we'll see improvement in the numbers, but not necessarily in the end markets.
That's very helpful. And just lastly, on pricing versus raws, as your raws drop, do you think you'll hold on to pricing? And what could the impact be through the full course of the year as that gap widens?
Well, Dave, what we're trying to do is have the best of all worlds, okay? We'll try to hold on to the price. We definitely see raw materials coming down. But, you know, as we think about it on a business-by-business basis across company, we're obviously trying to manage the spread between, you know, price and raw materials. So if you notice in George's walk, okay, on our coming off of Q1, you won't see price or materials embedded in there anyplace. The reality is we know material prices are coming down, probably the order of magnitude of $100 million or so for the rest of the year. But for this modeling and so forth, we've not done anything on, you know, from a profit improvement on that, because to some degree we'll probably have to give up a little bit of price in the back half of the year.
I think, Dave, there's a kind of a race condition that's going to take place. Right now, our price seems to be holding okay. We're not seeing the sort of intense pressure that some people perhaps thought. But I think it's clear that if the economy doesn't improve, we will see that pressure. And as Pat said, the trick is to manage the spread between price and raw materials. But I also think there's this kind of race condition which is taking place between pressure on price and upward pressure on the economy. And if the economy responds a little better than some of us might think, then I think that pressure goes away and the year ends up being quite positive.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Your next question comes from the line of Jeff Sprague with Citigroup. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
Just a question on Asia, George, if you could drill a little further into that. Interesting that it was actually the weakest geography from a local currency standpoint. To what degree do you think that is kind of the export-related phenomenon into the developed world, or, how much of it is really kind of organic weakness in those end markets? And I guess the gist of my question is, you're still relatively low penetration in some of those Asian markets. You know, what is the opportunity in the downturn to push penetration higher?
Well, if you take, thanks, Jeff, if you take Japan as probably the almost a sort of poster child for what can go wrong in Asia, their market is really concerns three things: automotive, electronics, and machine tools. And they've all been just absolutely pummeled, as you well know. So I think that it answers the question implicitly that you talked about, that certainly in Asia, and we map this, Jeff, in Asia, more of the economy is tied to export than any other region of the world, obviously the United States and Asia, Europe included in that. So I think you're absolutely right, David, it's driven by export. But what's beginning to happen is some of these economies are now doing internal sort of in-country stimulus, China being perhaps the best example of that. And their economy is responding. So it may be that we'll see the initial betterment in the economy coming from internal stimulus packages, Jeff, and then obviously in turn as the rest of the world begins to pull its socks up and begin to improve, we'll see that pull through into Asia. So I think it is, as you rightly point out, it's because of the export-led nature of that particular economy. Japan is really the worst of the examples for us. China is not doing all that badly, and we expect it to begin to do better. And probably, as I've mentioned in my comments, I think Asia will certainly be at the front, if not lead us, certainly will be alongside the United States in leading us out of recession.
And on pension, Pat, if you were to lock down on current returns and discount rates, can you give us some view of what type of headwind you look at in 2010 on pension?
Good question, Jeff. hopefully I don't lock down on where we're currently at. What we're having a tendency to model is, you know, what happens if we get back to kind of a zero return for the year and, you know, discount rates don't change. Now, the reality is discount rates have moved, okay, pretty significantly. So if I took a balanced view, is we're probably looking someplace in the order of about a $200 million year-on-year hit from 9 to 10 relative to our pension expense. And let's face it, that number is going to be volatile. We'll see when we get to the end of the year. But if I was a model today, a 0% asset return and kind of a flat discount market, that'd give us about a $200 million hit year-on-year.
Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from the line of Scott Davis with Morgan Stanley. Please proceed with your question.
Sure. Hi. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Scott.
I know you buy a lot of different materials, and the prices changed pretty drastically in the last, well, more towards the end of last year and early this year. How much do you think FIFO helped you out in the quarter, if at all?
I'd say I don't think it helped us at all in we still think we're probably going through, Scott, about the peak, okay, of our material cost in Q1, probably a little bit average between Q4 and Q1. So, you know, back half we've maybe got a little benefit. But the slower volumes here in the first quarter, okay, really kind of hurt our ability to, you know, kind of get through that that higher cost layer as fast as we would have liked to. So I would say Q1 is a, you know, kind of, you know, the high level relative to the cost of goods sold.
Okay. I know I asked this question last quarter, but I'm just curious to see if it's changed at all. I mean, when you think about the big picture, the supply chain fix that you have is kind of a 7-year gig that you talked about, but you could make an argument that this restructuring pulls forward a lot of that and helps you prepare for the next upcycle. I mean, how do you guys think about? Is that real, or am I kind of
Scott, let me. I'll answer, you know, the way I will, and then George can pipe in. The our supply chain efforts are continuing on. It's a, you know, it's a day-to-day exercise. So there's two sides to this. One is that as we've cut back our CapEx spending, it has somewhat probably slowed down some of our longer-term moves that we were looking to make, partially because we just don't have some of the demand that we needed, which was going to put some of our facilities in, I'll call it, from a better local supply standpoint. So to some degree, that has slowed some of that effort down as far as a, you know, kind of a longer-term, larger CapEx investment. So some of those plans have kind of slowed down a little bit. But the I'll call it the untangling a lot of the hairball that George has kind of talked to a lot of you about is that's a day-to-day effort, plant by plant, it's product by product, it's process by process, and all that stuff continues to go on. But to be fair, there are some pieces that had to do with some longer term, bigger moves that we had in mind that we have put on the back burner here for at least the near term.
So what it will do, Scott, is basically supply. It'll push that those supply chain initiatives essentially to the right for a year, and just underscore Pat's point. There were really three elements. One was the building of local plants close to markets, which was the stuff that was visible in that 17, 18, 19 plant bills. There was a second element of this, again, which was about capacity adding, which was the building of super hubs that really looked to the future about where the demand might be and trying to locate a set of plants with multiple businesses in them that could respond regionally. Then the third one, which Pat sort of mentioned, was this internal hairball back in the United States where we had multiple plant shunts. That's kind of, and that didn't include or didn't need either the opening or closing of plants. That's ongoing. We're doing that. And that will bring its benefits. So you are right in the sense that that's still ongoing, and will deliver benefits later on in working capital improvements and overall efficiency and fill rates, I think. But to be fair, the other elements of it will get slid to the right.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Our next question comes from the line of Steven Winoker with Sanford Bernstein. Please proceed with your question.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Steve.
First question I have is on operating leverage. As I think about the cost reductions going on, the operating leverage in the first quarter was 1.9 times on my math, which implies on the low end of the guidance or the range of the guidance about 0.5 to 0.8 for the rest of the year. So a significant improvement. And you've talked about a bunch of the cost reduction action. But could you maybe give a little bit more color for sort of what really has to go right to hit that kind of betterment on the operating leverage side?
Yeah, first of all, Steve, the models don't always work the same going down as they do on the upside. You know, you've got a fair amount of fixed cost in, you know, business and so forth. And, you know, when you've got especially a relatively large manufacturing organization, even though you try your darndest to try to take all the inventory out of the system and run, you know, lean and so forth, there is a certain element of inefficiency that you have in your manufacturing processes when volumes contract as rapidly as they have. You just can't completely right-size all of your manufacturing, your supply chains overnight. So there's an element of inefficiency that does happen on the downside, especially in a very dramatic decline scenario. On the upside, the way I think of it is we've laid out a number of restructuring actions that we're talking about. What's critical to us, though, is we've got to hold the line on our staffing levels and our spending as when volume comes back. And so we've got very stringent controls in place to make sure that both our spending and staffing levels hold at current levels until it's very, very clear that there truly is a long-term, you know, volume uptick here, to make sure you don't get a bunch of false positives and you start to respond prematurely. So we have to execute the restructuring. We have to continue to focus on gaining share where we can, and, you know, get some additional business. But importantly, we have to get the leverage here on the upside. You know, what we tell the businesses is we spend money to restructure your business. We can't be putting these people back in when the volume, you know, returns. So we've got to become a leaner, you know, organization as the volume comes back.
Does that imply a certain amount of capacity reduction across the business that you could sort of quantify, order of magnitude?
No, I wouldn't say it. It's very, not on a large scale. I wouldn't say that we're taking a lot of plants out. We will be altering some of our more developed market supply chains. Back to Scott's question a little bit, which is just kind of a normal, piece of business. It's fair to say, we have a fair amount at this level. We have a fair amount of excess, capacity. But when you look at, we don't see this as being a permanent, a permanent volume level. It's very clear that, maybe it doesn't bounce back in the next 6 months. But as George kind of outlined, by probably 2011 or so, we're back to 07 level. So we're not going to rip up our capacity and our structure in response to the current conditions. So in the meantime, we've got to do some extraordinary efforts here to make sure that we bring down the cost and are really able to maintain our capability on a long-term basis. One of the things that we're looking to do is to bring in a bunch of business from the outside into some of our plants to fully utilize it and so forth. So we have a number of those actions going on, Steve.
Okay, and then just finally, on your five-year product vitality index, which was about, 25% or so in 2008 and thought would be more than 30% this year, is that still the number that you're targeting, or what number are you looking for this year?
It's Fred just gave us a report just the other day, and it's gone up by another couple of points. Whether by the end of the year it makes it to 30 is yet to be determined. Obviously, you've got overall sales falls, both new product and replacement products. But I think we will continue to take meaningful and helpful steps down that pathway. So I think overall the news will be positive, even if it's not exactly that number that you just mentioned.
And Steve, one of the bright lights here is that if you go back and track that metric for a period of time, so much of that new product vitality metric used to be optical. Now it's made up of broad-based business growth across all the divisions of the company. So it's a lot solider development program that we've got going on now.
That number, Steve, back in the optical heyday, in the 2004-2005 time frame, was down in for the core of 3M was down in single digits. So so what it tells you is the is the underlying health of the core of the business and the innovation in the core of the business is very, very strong, very, very much alive and well. And it's not going to take very many years, maybe only another couple, to really get this back to the point where we it's going to be the engine, in a sense, that drives that underlying 5 to 8% organic growth that Pat and I are looking for, all these economic downturns notwithstanding.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Our next question comes from the line of John McNulty with Credit Suisse. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Good morning, John.
With regard to working capital, you certainly made some headway, but clearly not probably as much as you wanted to, given that you've still got some inventories that you need to work down, and there's some high-cost inventory in there as well. Can you give us some color as to where you think or what you think you can squeeze out of working capital throughout the rest of the year to help drive the cash flow?
Well, John, let me try to deal with inventory kind of in isolation here for a second. We probably need to make about the same level of improvement. If you wash out FX and acquisitions, we had about $250 million for the period here. We probably need to make another similar improvement over the rest, you know, the rest of the year would be the level of improvement. The thing on receivables is so sales volume dependent. We will maintain our days outstanding, I think, in a relatively tight position, but it will vary depending upon what volume scenario you're looking at.
Okay, great. And then just one other question with regard to cash flow. Your balance sheet's in pretty solid shape at this point. There are a lot of companies out there that are struggling. Any reason to think or that maybe stepping up into the M&A markets a little more aggressively would make sense for you at this point?
Well, you have to keep an eye on what the marketplace is, and of course we're trying to balance a combination of our liquidity, our credit position in the market as well. So we'll take a look at all those for the right the right kind of deal, the right kind of value. We will continue to entertain those for the long term health of the company.
I think, John, that in the rare places where we've touched this, we're not finding companies who are perhaps as realistic on price as many people from the outside looking in might think. So in some ironic way, if this continues for a little bit longer, I think that situation is going to change. Some of those people are going to be perhaps more incentivized to listen more sensibly. So I think the longer it goes on, the more likely that kind of issue is. But we're just going to have to see. As Pat said, we'll take it on a case-by-case basis.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Our next question comes from the line of John Inch with Merrill Lynch. Please proceed with your question.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Morning, John.
Morning. So, George, I think you mentioned that flat panel TVs were looking better.
Yeah.
My question is, I know that if you go back in time, we had sort of talked, or we as in you had sort of talked about being designed out of a lot of this stuff. Is flat panel TV going forward still significant? And maybe you could dovetail that with a little bit of this eco-friendly product you've got. Like, how significant could flat panel be for you in an upcycle if volumes for televisions improve?
Well, it's an amazing thing, John. It's like sort of tidal ebbs and flows in this business. You know that so much of this design in, design out is real time, and these guys in the end markets, Samsung and LG and Sony, they're in really, really tough markets, and so they use innovation, they use latest mega trends as a means of driving their volume. And one of the obvious mega trends has been, and it's really right across the industry, John. It's in the battery-powered devices, it's a drive toward extended battery life. In the electrically-powered devices, it's a drive toward lower energy costs. And the beauty of the kind of films that 3M has, and films which are protected by intellectual property, I'm thinking in particular the multi-layer film, DBEF, are the ones that give you this facility. So what's actually happening now, John? A lot of the panel manufacturers are able to get from 4 down to 2 lamps or 8 lamps down to 5, and get 30, 40, or even a little more out of the energy out of the panel. And when you realize that they're saving on lamps and they're saving on inverters and they're putting in films, it's actually more or less a net trade. And so the end customer, assuming that the panel manufacturers can find it in their way to pass this through to the set manufacturers and then to the retail customers, you can have today a set consuming roughly 40% less of the energy for the same price as you could for one to its right that's not. And so that seems to be gathering a lot of momentum, John, and it really has taken hold in the marketplace. So I think that in terms of just square footage of film manufacturing, it's probably got a pretty good upside. But all of us have been burned by the commoditization of this particular market, so I'm not going to get out ahead of myself. But I do think that significant increases in volume, John, of course muted by price and affected by what kind of film it is on, you know, margin wise. But nevertheless, I think this has the possibility, John, in a perverse and ironic twist of history, of giving us a little bit of upside in the display and graphics market. So all those conversations that you and I have had about this market, which are very challenging, may get better in the coming months. The trick, John, still is to make sure all of the high margin business, the better performing businesses like handhelds, don't see some similar switches in technology to what TV did. It's not happening yet, John, but it's something that we are, having once been burned, we are very aware of. So I think the overall the news is more positive than it once was.
Yeah, and I think that's it. And John, I just want to make sure you don't misread anything we say. It's not going to go back to where it was.
It's never going to go back, John.
But definitely is a sequentially better than the performance in the TV section during the past year.
In fact, even in this quarter, John, even though we report year over year numbers, if you look sequentially, fourth quarter to first quarter, very significant improvements in profit in that business and in margin in that business. So certainly the trend has turned.
George, I know you guys had shuttered capacity in optical film. Given what you're describing, are you now, would you characterize your situation as being right-sized to be able to benefit from this trend, or would you foresee even possibly adding a little bit of capacity down the road?
No, I don't think there's any capacity needed, John. Where we've shuttered some capacity, it's been in the converters, the guys really out in Asia for the most part. The manufacturing capacity here has not been shuttered. There is some manufacturing capacity, John, being repurposed for window films, which are obviously being driven by the interest in ecology and interest in energy consumption. So no, I think we're okay right now. And as much as this we can get, Pat and I'll be dancing in the streets.
Yeah, and do you guys have a sense of what your global capacity utilization might be with respect to current volumes? I'm trying to think of a little bit of the opportunity to reabsorb some fixed costs as volumes at some point come back and sort of trying to bridge a little bit of the upside-downside scenario you've presented in the 09.
Hey, John, I'll let George take a shot. Our businesses are so different, our processes are so different from a capacity perspective. It's, giving you a number is, it's kind of interesting, and my guess is probably in the 70s range is kind of where as I think about it. But you got extreme examples, okay? You got businesses and consumer today that are running, very, very well. Healthcare running very, very well. Industrial and electrical communications, of course, we got some plants that are running, a third, okay? So, you got sizable, sizable spreads across the portfolio.
In renewable energy, John, we can't keep up with the demand. In diaper tapes, it's the same issue, really very, very rapid growth. But yet you've got other things that are automotive related are at the opposite end. So I think, it really is, Pat's absolutely right. Hard to give you a blended number, but it's probably in the, within a couple of points of 70%.
Okay. And then just lastly, could you remind us what your exposure is roughly to commercial construction? I'm just trying to think of, you're clearly a short cycle company. I'm just trying to think, are there some temperaments that we should maybe be cognizant of just as those end markets?
John, I wouldn't even worry. I mean, it's not a significant piece for us. It'd be, at best a couple points, okay? Even if I'd have to probably round up to get there.
It's mostly residential, John. And You know, we began to see that misery going back really to the end of 2006. So you know, we've lived through most of the construction misery that's likely to be thrown at us.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks very much.
Thanks, John.
Our next question comes from the line of Steve Tusa with J.P. Morgan. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
I have a question, George. You know, when you first came in, it was a little bit bumpy with regards to you know, the visibility on the DNG issue, and obviously, you know, we've had a tough economy for the last 6 to 9 months, and nobody's been, you know, very good at predicting things. You know, what gives you the confidence now to use the term bottom? And are you comfortable that, you know, you've been around here long enough now and you've, you know, been ingrained in the culture and are comfortable with your systems enough so that, you know, you think you have the visibility to make that kind of comment? You know, if you could just comment on that, it'd be great.
Sure, Steve, sorry. I sort of alluded to this a little bit early in the conference call, Steve, when I said, you know, we can't take a view on on what's happening from an order book because our order books are typically 30 days out, and there isn't going to be a change materially anyway in 30 days out. So we have to build other kind of models about how we believe the economy will respond. Our observations are based on those models. You know, we've looked at historical models by analysing the recessions. Going right over the last 100 years in the United States, looking at the length of the cycles, how much of the time they spend in recession, how deep they are, looking at the last cycles, looking at the longest cycles, the shortest cycles, and we've built a model that leads us to the conclusion that I iterated, Steve, that a bottom somewhere between the... This is end markets, Steve, not necessarily wholesale markets. Because obviously, if you see a transient in the end market, it ripples back through the supply chain and is often magnified. That's why you see IPI in the first quarter at 13, but you see, say, our sales and ITW sales and other companies' sales down in the 20s, because the channel is clearing the inventory out. And what is so key to making an assessment on the year, Steve, is how fast that inventory might clear out. So you can actually, and the perverse nature of this, Steve, is you could have those inventory transients die down where wholesale and retail, shall we call it that, for want of a better description, are in stasis or a match, but yet you've seen an improvement from down 21 to down 13. It's still miserable, but at least it's an improvement. So we are not expecting, Steve, any significant improvements in the end markets, but we have to take a view on how the economy is doing. We have to take a view on how efficient the channel is clearing out inventory in rolling up these kind of forecasts as to what generally happens in the economy. But oddly enough, if you take the way that I rolled up the numbers and the way Pat rolled up the numbers, you take that first quarter performance and you add, you know, a little bit of stock option back in, you add a little bit of Venezuela back in, and even a little bit of the inventory correction stuff back in, and then systematically things that we know we can control, the vacation, the restructuring which is going to come to us, makes the assumption that we hold the costs constant, Steve, and a few other bits and pieces, and it looks to us like we can get to the it looks like we can get to the 390 even if the economy doesn't improve all year. So we just can't bring ourselves from all that we know, from the green shoots that we know, from the performance of the channels in electronics, for example, that we know, we can't get ourselves to the point where we think that anything significantly worse than that 390 would come in. So it's just a lot harder, Steve, and you know this business very well. It's just harder to make an assessment in a company like this because we don't have an order book, so you've got to make those assessments of the channel, and you've got to make those assessments of the market, and they're the ones that we've made.
Great. And then just one more big picture question. You know, you guys touch the consumer in a lot of areas, and you know, you've got a great R&D budget and spend a lot on marketing, and I'm sure you guys, you know, study this every day. you know, from the feedback from your guys, is there any risk that there is, you know, a kind of a structural change here in the consumer behavior, you know, that's not as temporary as some might think? You know, it's kind of a structural trade down that, you know, there's risk that 3M will not get paid for the kind of innovation that they have gotten paid for historically. Is there any concern around that kind of dynamic as we go into this, you know, less leveraged world where people just, you know, feel a little less rich?
It's an interesting question, Steve. It really is. I think you can answer this at two or three levels. I'm an import to this country, but I do observe about my wonderful adopted countrymen that old habits die hard, and so at the consumer level, I think that kind of behavior pattern probably won't last. It doesn't mean that there won't be a little bit of lag, Steve, but I don't think it will last. Now, in the industrial spaces, Steve, I think the question is a little tougher. Certainly, what we've really kind of found is a combination of things, Steve, is some people moving down the market. You know, we classically describe the market as good, better, best. But what we've actually, and we kind of draw it as a pyramid, you know, with a smaller top and a wider bottom. But what's actually happened, Mo made a great point about this, what he's seeing is the pyramid changing to an hourglass, where the middle is shrinking and people are either moving up to better products, more reliable suppliers, people they can turn to in tough times, and to some degree those who are in trouble moving down markets and expanding the bottom of the markets. But what we've done, and it's really happened, I think you were there, Steve, the first time that I ever presented to this group in this company, we talked about how we can capture some of the bottom of the market, not only for growth opportunities, but as a bulwark against the encroachment of foreign competition, low-cost competition. So I actually think, oddly enough, we've positioned ourselves extremely well. And you'll see new products coming out in, I probably shouldn't tell you the marketplace, in a number of different segments where we've responded to that. Already the products are available, ready to launch. And I think we're going to be well placed, Steve, to capture this growth in this marketplace wherever it happens, even if there is the kind of secular change that you're implying in your question.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Stay safe.
Our next question comes from the line of Shannon O'Callaghan with Barclays Capital. Please proceed with your question.
Morning, guys.
Morning, Shannon.
Hey, on the inventory reduction comment, when you mentioned the gross margin impact. I mean, when you think about that along the segments, I mean, can you quantify which segments got hit the hardest by that?
Well, as I think you'd probably expect, it's the ones that have the steepest volume decline. So I think it's a direct correlation. That's not to say that we're not, you know, driving improvements in consumer and healthcare, but there's just much more of a need right now in those businesses who've seen the biggest volume reductions to adjust their output plans. So.
For industrial and transportation, Electra, I mean, do you have any size of what you think that hurt you by?
Oh, no, I would say, you know, if at the company level we said we're about a point and a half, you could probably take those businesses and say they're probably 2 points plus, you know. You know, that's kind of a back-of-the-seat answer, Shannon.
Okay. What about on the flip side then? I mean, you had kind of the blowout margins in healthcare and consumer and office were you know, held in impressively well too. I mean, was there, you know, anything you discount there in terms of mix or something and going forward?
No, I think it's fair to say that with our industrial related businesses and electronics hurting as bad, we did have to probably choke off some spending in healthcare and consumer for the good of the company, not long term, but at least from a timing standpoint. Part of the reason consumers' margins improved was just some timing of some of our merchandising programs and so forth, and we'll have to manage those as the year goes on. As one of the great things about having the portfolio of businesses you've got is you've got a third of our portfolio who is really doing reasonably well in this environment. Really trying to help out the other piece of it.
I think long term, Shannon. Clearly, this healthcare business is just a great place to invest. It just is a great place to invest. You know, for all sorts of different reasons: growth rates, absence of volatility and just the overall quality of margins. You know, our sort of long-term view in the healthcare business is margins. They're in the late 20s, but obviously those kind of margins are going to be with much higher growth rates, and there'll be some transitioning. It's possible that these margins would ease a little bit as growth picks up, as we invest more in R&D and we push the product a little harder. But this is just fundamentally just a great segment with great possibilities, great growth, great margins, and we are just so glad to have it.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jen.
Our final question comes to the line of John Roberts with Buckingham Research. Please proceed with your question.
Morning, guys.
Morning, John.
Some people are looking at China as kind of the leading indicator of the economic cycle, and I think there have already been reports of at least domestic consumption turning up for the last couple of months in China. It sounded like you were still waiting to see it. You expect it, but it sounded like you hadn't seen it yet.
No, it's begun to happen. I think that, you know, the fourth quarter, John, was something of a shock to a lot of people in the way that volume fell off. But no, we are seeing that. That's the kind of reports we're getting out of our Chinese folks, that they're seeing that domestic volume picking up. And of course, obviously, what they hope is the balance of the year and the balance of the world responds, that they'll see that going back to the old ways of export led. So I think that it seems that Chinese stimulus package, John, is beginning to get traction and working reasonably well.
Is it your consumer materials, your consumer related stuff, or is it your infrastructure products that you would have in China?
It's mostly everywhere. That business that we have over there, John, is a kind of China for China. It's not a China for export necessarily. It's not how we set it up. So I think when those internal economy markets improve, we're just going to ride this along with on a kind of general GDP like improvement in the China economy.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
That concludes the question and answer portion of our conference. At this time, we will turn the call back over to 3M for some closing comments.
Well, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. Hopefully, we answered your questions well, and we look forward to talking to you next time.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. You may all disconnect, and thank you for participating.